Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I'm already doing a bad job of this, being distracted during the intro. Go me. Hey, we're looking at book 11, chapter 8, part 1. Whoa, the big reveal. What are your thoughts about that? And I'm still not sure why Ivan is guilty, quote unquote, as Smurdy insists. Question 2, Terrific comes to the rescue. I think this is Dosto's beliefs coming to the fore. Somerstars mentioned yesterday that Ivan has no guilt in the murder, according to modern thought. In a legal sense, I don't think Ivan would be held responsible, even in Dosto's age. I think Dosto is pointing towards a more moral, ethical guilt. Perhaps metaphysical guilt is a better term. Dosto is showing that ideas have consequences. Ivan's nihilism has influenced Smerdyakov. In Dosto's view, Ivan has to share part of the guilt because of what he taught Smurdy, and that he, when faced with a choice to put a stop to the murder, he looked away. I'm not sure I agree with Dosto's conclusions, but I think this is what he's trying to convey to us. Somerstars said, I agree with a lot of this. This whole book has been Dosto's attempt to justify and push his belief system on others. This is another example of it. I personally find his logic quite flawed in places, which unfortunately has dampened my enjoyment of the book. Also, in a bit of an amusing twist, very early into the book I saw some spoilers that I thought said Ivan killed Fyodor, but didn't revisit the spoilers again after that. So this whole time I've been reading the book waiting for the reveal of Ivan as the killer. To discover it was Smurdy was like a wait, what? Confusing moment. Laughing until tears come out of your eyes emoji. Terrific said one of life's many ironies. He's flawed. His logic is very flawed in my view, but he sort of makes a virtue of those inconsistencies. He thinks logic is a way to the gulags, to the tyranny of the mind. I think it was George Steiner who said that choosing between Dosto and Tolstoy is a choice between two worldviews, between the irrational, emotional-driven, and the rational, thought-driven worldviews. This dichotomy opens up a space for a third way, exemplified by Hermann Hesse's book Siddhartha. I think it's interesting that we haven't resolved this fight that is ongoing in each individual human being. Some ignore it, but most of us are aware of it, and explored to great effect by Dosto, Tolstoy, Hesse, Mann, George Eliot, Mary Shelley, Bulgakov, and many, many other authors. Hey, good list. Hermann Hesse is one of my favourites. I really love his book Steppenwolf. But I'll tell you what, Siddhartha is maybe his most popular book, and his most influential, but I can't get through it. You know what? I can't get through it. I find the narrative quite condescending, because you've got that is the main guy Siddhartha, and then he's got his like disciple, and everything that disciple like asks him, like, but master, why are we doing this? And then always when Siddhartha talks to his disciple, it's so condescending. It's always like, oh, you little idiot, watch and I shall show you the way to true life. And that's how it came across to me, and in turn I felt like I was being condescended to a lot, like kind of spoon-fed a worldview, as Tech called it. But I suppose, like, if it was a new worldview at that time, I suppose it probably needed to be spoon-fed. Now, in retrospect, it might seem a little bit trite. I should revisit that book. It's only short, too. Can't take too long. But in the meantime, I would recommend to all you guys Steppenwolf by Hermann Hesse. Really good book. Somerstars said, of Tolstoy and Dosto, who does Steiner label the logic-driven and the emotional one? I could see being able to argue that either author does both, although Tolstoy seems more obviously emotion-driven. My therapist often says that the emotional kind has a really good way of disguising itself as a logical or wise... the logical mind has a really good way of disguising itself as a logical or wise mind, and I think this is super true in Dosto's case. He tries really hard to present his arguments as logical, but ultimately they are emotional at their root. His beliefs are something he feels, and feels strongly about, and is trying to justify his views in the Brothers Karamazov through logic. This is why his logic falls short in some places, because the root of his view is emotional and he can't quite capture it in logical thought. Yeah, I think a good way that I can conceptualize this debate between emotional rationality and logical is the remembering that we see through a human lens, which developed aside from science, through logic, I suppose. And so to see things in a rational and logical way doesn't always mean to see them in a human way. And so both of them can be true, because human truths are true to us because we're humans, and scientific truths are true in a rational way. So they're two different types of true which are equally as valid. And so you don't need to skew to one or the other, you just need to understand where the divide exists. It's always been the way I think about that divide. Techrific said, Dosto preferred emotion over rationality, although Steiner made this point that Tolstoy has a more positive rational outlook. But at the end of his life, he became a Christian mystic, so things are never as clear-cut as literature professors want them to be. But what is clear is that Dostoevsky didn't believe we could perfect this world. He thought that way of thinking led to war, gulags, and misery. Tolstoy did believe that humanity could at least make an effort towards a better future, and Dostoy left all that to God. Ah, interesting. The question then remains, was Dostoy right or not? Because the path continued and did lead to gulags, war, and misery. I suppose he predated Nietzsche, who predated the gulags. You can kind of draw a line through the three of them. In response to the therapist bit, Techrific said, I agree with your therapist. Also, we live in a world where we increasingly mistake emotions for thoughts, and we think that we are our feelings. The middle way is sort of an effort to try to reconcile our both sides. The strange thing is how much we're still governed by our emotions. It is scary. Is that middle way you speak of there, is that the main message of Siddhartha, to reconcile the two sides? Because I never got through the book. I read a quarter of it, maybe. Hume said, reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions, and can never pretend to any other office to serve and obey them. I don't agree with him. Being ruled by our passions leads to problems. I am Norwegian, said I might be biased in favor of Dosto, but I seriously doubt that he was unaware of how he was writing the book. I see this being less as propaganda and more an expression of what Dosto wanted to express. I don't think he is trying to present anything as purely logical or rational. Instead, he simply expressed how he views the world. So much of the book is about metaphysics, and you cannot boil metaphysics down to logic or reason. It invariably ends up as faith and trying to understand the transcendent. Or in other words, the book is, here are my beliefs, acted out and tested, instead of, here are the reasons for why you should believe me. Consider how strong of a case has been made against religion repeatedly in the book. That was logic and reason. The hero of the book, however, is not a master of logic and reason, quite the opposite. And yet he is the hero. Why? Because he exemplifies active love, because he is good. Even in doubt and confusion, Zossima too does not make his case through hard reason. He talks about loving plants and seeing God in birds. Oh dear, God, you guys went deep on this one. All right. Techrific hit back saying, I don't think he made a strong case for the opposition. He thinks nihilism is the end unto itself, but as Nietzsche pointed out, it is merely the beginning. Well, he tried to point that out and drove himself crazy and died. He went for it. We must still have values in order to live. God is dead for mankind, not because his existence is against reason, but because the belief in him is in opposition to the very same morality God has supported in terms of revenger and punisher. God has been killed by morality, not by reason. It's the demand for honesty, Wahrheit, that makes belief in God impossible. For an honest human being, all efforts at faith are excuses and play-acting. Nietzsche made this starting point it's not the result. God. For the honest human being, all efforts at faith are excuses and play acting. Jeez. Is that your words, Tech? Or is that a Nietzsche paraphrase? The way I understand the death of God is roughly like this, says Norwegian. Christianity emphasizes truth and the search for truth. In the process of searching for truth, the West experiences an epistemic shift away from metaphysics, which is rejected in favor of a more reasonable and evidence-based materialism and naturalism. In cutting away our roots, the tree withers away and we suffer spiritually, losing whatever value religion held for us. Irrespective of the reality of God, the result is that people try to fit ideology into the religious metastructure in us that cannot tolerate nothing being there, and that people turn nihilist and suffer. He didn't make a strong case for the opposition, but I don't think that was the goal. It was not nihilism he argued against as much as it was the modern rationalism that was sweeping the West. The book was always going to be a work in favor of Christianity, but it's more nuanced and complicated, a more nuanced and complicated one than I have ever seen. It's not exactly apologia. Apologia. What's that? A formal written defense of one's opinions or conduct. Apologia.
Apologia.
I'm not sure about that, though. I think there's more nuance here than I'm grasping. I do think the one thing we keep clashing about is values and meaning without metaphysics grounded in something with transcendence. Techrific said, we discuss this in the Grand Inquisitor chapter. The God of the Bible has created a conundrum for himself, herself, itself. He has created us sick and demanded us to be well, as Christopher Hitchens puts it. I can't remember exactly how we formulated the problem. I think it was user Somastars that formulated the problem the best. But the killing of innocent children on a daily basis can never be moral, even if it's God who allows it. It's the old theodicy problem, raising its pesky head again, I'm afraid. I am Norwegian said, but is that why God died? People have wrestled with this question for as long as Christianity has been a thing, and people did just that instead of renouncing or rejecting faith in God. I've only heard one convincing answer to the theodicy problem, but I can't remember where. I know by who, though, so I'll try to find it. I won't try to make the argument, being unable to do it justice. Well, I hope you do find it. I am Norwegian, but I hope I get a chance to read it. I am Norwegian said, I think there is going to be significant resistance towards Dostoevsky's point here, so I will try to reframe it in a way that we would all understand better, or at least be more sympathetic to. Imagine that Ivan was an anti-Semite, that he went on and on about the evils of Jews to Smurdy. If Smurdy then ended up killing a Jew, would we blame Ivan? Of course we would. This is even clearer if you make it wholly political and imagine Ivan to be a Nazi. Wherever his Nazi rhetoric would take root and express itself, we would blame Ivan for it also, wouldn't we? I understand that these feel very different, but I'm not sure if I can see the difference in logic. Ivan managed to influence the beliefs of Smurdy in such a way that he killed Fyodor. The fact that it was metaphysical beliefs that were altered doesn't matter. The importance of metaphysical beliefs in the modern world is vastly underestimated. You might say, but Smurdy was already a weirdo. Have you looked at modern neo-Nazis? We have a responsibility in what we say and how we act, and therefore in what we believe. What do you think about that, Somastars? Oh, golly. Somastars said, I'm going to step back from the argument as you presented it to point out that I don't think comparing Ivan's beliefs and what's happening with Smerdyakov to Nazis is an apple-to-apple comparison. No matter where Smerdyakov took things, Ivan didn't advocate murder. The Nazis did advocate and participate in murder. Yeah, I think he was extrapolating the example to an extreme, but Smurdy is the one responsible for his action. I don't think you could fairly say Ivan is guilty of murder, but I think you could say he should feel some guilt for, what do they say, like not an accomplice, but there's a word for that. Someone who kind of like knowingly allows for a crime to happen. Like doesn't actively stop it. There is a word for that. It's not an accomplice, it's a something. Oh, damn. It's on the tip of my tongue too. An accessory? An accessory. He's an accessory to murder, right? Isn't that what he would be? I Am Norwegian said, good point. I skipped a comment. Terrific said, how do we arbitrate that kind of guilt and blame? Dostoevsky has made several anti-Semitic remarks in this book, as you know. Do we blame him for the Holocaust? How much does he share in the blame for that? He perpetuated views held by Russians against Jews that were used as excuses in pogroms. Does he share blame in those horrific pogroms, even if he never actively participated in any himself? Food for thought. There's a whole nother rabbit hole linking down from there, but I think we are kind of turning a corner a little bit, where it's a bit of a departure from the argument, so I'm going to skip ahead of that. I will just say Laura Weistich's response, because we don't see much from Laura Weistich, and I like to read Laura's comments. In the story, it's less important about arbitrating and more significant that Smurdy is making Ivan blame himself. Plus, Ivan is afraid of what people will think of him more than receiving punishment. Less important about arbitrating and more significant that Smurdy is making Ivan blame himself. Okay, so the focus isn't really whether or not Ivan is to blame. We should be talking about the fact that Smurdy is actively trying to elicit guilt from Ivan. He's playing him still. Uncle Josselmeyer said, then it is not manipulation and mind games. Smurdy actually believes that Ivan was giving him tacit orders to kill Fyodor. That is his justification. This guy is really twisted. Well, I don't know. I think that kind of goes against what that last comment that Laura Weistich said about the fact that he is actively trying to make Ivan feel guilty. He's trying to make Ivan blame himself. I think he's doing that in a manipulative way. He knows he did the crime. Smurdy knows he did the actions of killing the man, but yet he's still trying to lay the blame on someone else. Fake Plastic Trees 12 said, Ivan, since the beginning of the novel, has shown firm and even rigid convictions and absolutist, but gradually we discover that when surfaced with a conflict, he is torn apart by self-doubt. Ivan's guilt was planted by Smerdyakov, which was only strengthened by Ivan's recurring self-doubt. Smurdy is playing on an existing self-doubt, I would say. That would be how I would say that. Don't you think that he's intentionally playing on those emotions? All right, keen. Oops, sorry, bumped the microphone. I am keen now to continue and finish this chapter. And that set it all going and set my mind at rest, is where we ended yesterday. He stopped. That was the beginning of chapter 8, book 11, chapter 8. Now we'll read the second part. He stopped. Ivan had listened all the time in dead silence without stirring or taking his eyes off him. As he told his story, Smerdyakov glanced at him from time to time, but for the most part kept his eyes averted. When he had finished, he was evidently agitated and was breathing hard. The perspiration stood out on his face, but it was impossible to tell whether it was remorse he was feeling or what. Stay, cried Ivan, pondering. What about the door? If he only opened the door to you, how could Grigory have seen it open before? For Grigory saw it before you went. It was remarkable that Ivan spoke quite amicably in a different tone, not angry as before. So if anyone had opened the door at that moment and peeped in at them, he would certainly have concluded that they were talking peaceably about some ordinary, though interesting, subject. As for that door and having seen it open, that's only his fancy, said Smerdyakov with a wry smile. He is not a man, I assure you, but an obstinate mule. He didn't see it, but fancied he had seen it, and there's no shaking him. It's just our luck he took that notion into his head, for they can't fail to convict Dmitri Fyodorovich after that. Listen, said Ivan, beginning to seem bewildered again and making an effort to grasp something. Listen, there are a lot of questions I want to ask you, but I forget them. I keep forgetting and getting mixed up. Yes, tell me this at least. Why did you open the envelope and leave it there on the floor? Why didn't you simply carry off the envelope? When you were telling me, I thought you spoke about it as though it were the right thing to do, but why, I can't understand. I did that for a good reason, for if a man had known all about it, as I did, for instance, if he'd seen those notes before and perhaps had put them in that envelope himself and had seen the envelope sealed up and addressed with his own eyes, if such a man had done the murder, what should have made him tear open the envelope afterwards, especially in such desperate haste, since he'd know for certain the notes must be in the envelope? No, if the robber had been someone like me, he'd simply have put the envelope straight in his pocket and got away with it as fast as he could. But it'd be quite different with Dmitri Fyodorovitch. He only knew about the envelope by hearsay. He had never seen it, and if he'd found it, for instance, under the mattress, he'd have torn it open as quickly as possible to make sure the notes were in it, and he'd have thrown the envelope down without having time to think that it would be evidence against him, because he was not an habitual thief and had never directly stolen anything before, for he is a gentleman born, and if he did bring himself to steal, it would not be regular stealing, but simply taking what was his own, for he'd told the whole town he'd meant to go to before, and had even bragged aloud before everyone that he'd go and take his property from Fyodor Pavlovitch. I didn't say that openly to the prosecutor when I was being examined, but quite the contrary, I brought him to it by a hint, as though I didn't see it myself, and as though he'd thought of it himself, and I hadn't prompted him so, that Mr. Prosecutor's mouth positively watered at my suggestion. "But can you possibly have thought of all that on the spot?" cried Ivan, overcome with astonishment. He looked at Smerdyakov again with alarm. "Mercy on us! Could anyone think of it all in such a desperate hurry? It was all thought out beforehand." "Well, well, it was the devil helped you," Ivan cried again. "No, you are not a fool. You are far cleverer than I thought." He got up, obviously intending to walk across the room. He was in terrible distress, but as the table blocked his way and there was hardly room to pass between the table and the wall, he only turned round where he stood and sat down again. Perhaps the impossibility of moving irritated him, as he suddenly cried out, almost as furiously as before, "Listen, you miserable, contemptible creature. Don't you understand that if I haven't killed you, it's simply because I am keeping you to answer tomorrow at the trial. God sees." Ivan raised his hand. "Perhaps I too was guilty. Perhaps I really had a secret desire for my father's death. But I swear I was not as guilty as you think. And perhaps I didn't urge you on at all. No, no, I didn't urge you on. But no matter. I will give evidence against myself tomorrow at the trial. I'm determined to. I shall tell everything, everything. But we'll make our appearance together. And whatever you may say against me at the trial, whatever evidence you give, I'll face it. I am not afraid of you. I'll confirm it all myself, but you must confess too. You must. We'll go together. That's how it shall be." Ivan said this solemnly and resolutely, and from his flashing eyes alone it could be seen that it would be so. "You are ill, I see. You are quite ill. Your eyes are yellow," Smerdyakov commented, without the least irony, with apparent sympathy, in fact. "We'll go together," Ivan repeated, "and if you won't go, no matter, I'll go alone." Smerdyakov paused as though pondering. "There'll be nothing of the sort, and you won't go," he concluded at last positively. "You don't understand me," Ivan exclaimed reproachfully. "You'll be too much ashamed if you confess at all, and what's more, it will be no use at all, for I shall say straight out that I never said anything of the sort to you, and that you are either ill, and it looks like it too, or that you are so sorry for your brother that you are sacrificing yourself to save him and have invented it all against me, for you've always thought no more of me than if I'd been a fly, and who will believe you, and what single proof have you got? Listen, you showed me those notes just now to convince me." Smerdyakov lifted the book of the notes and laid it on the side. "Take that money away with you," Smerdyakov sighed. "Of course I shall take it, but why do you give it to me if you committed the murder for the sake of it?" Ivan looked at him with great surprise. "I don't want it," Smerdyakov articulated in a shaking voice, with a gesture of refusal. "I did have an idea of beginning a new life with that money in Moscow, or better still, abroad. I did dream of it, chiefly because all things are lawful. That was quite right, what you taught me, for you talked a lot to me about that. For if there's no everlasting God, there's no such thing as virtue, and there's no need of it. You were right there. So that's how I looked at it." "Did you come to that yourself?" asked Ivan, with a wry smile. "With your guidance. And now I suppose you believe in God, since you are giving back the money." "No, I don't believe," whispered Smerdyakov. "Then why are you giving it back?" "Leave off. That's enough." Smerdyakov waved his hand again. "You used to say yourself that everything was lawful, so now why are you so upset, too?" You even want to go and give evidence against yourself, only there'll be nothing of the sort. You won't go to give evidence, Smerdyakov decided with conviction. You'll see, said Ivan. It isn't possible. You are very clever. You are very fond of money. I know that. You like to be respected, too, for you are very proud. You are far too fond of female charms, too, and you mind most of all about living in undisturbed comfort without having to depend on anyone. That's what you care most about. You won't want to spoil your life forever by taking such a disgrace on yourself. You are like Fyodor Pavlovich. You are more like him than any of his children. You've the same soul as he had. You are not a fool, said Ivan, seeming struck. The blood rushed to his face. You are serious now, he observed, looking suddenly at Smerdyakov with a different expression. It was your pride made you think I was a fool. Take the money. Ivan took the three rolls of notes and put them in his pocket, without wrapping them in anything. I shall show them at the court tomorrow, he said. Nobody will believe you, as you've plenty of money of your own. You may simply have taken it out of your cash box and brought it to the court. Ivan rose from his seat. I repeat, he said, the only reason I haven't killed you is that I need you for tomorrow. Remember that. Don't forget it. Well, kill me. Kill me now, Smerdyakov said all at once, looking strangely at Ivan. You won't dare do that even, he added, with a bitter smile. You won't dare to do anything, you who used to be so bold. Till tomorrow, cried Ivan, and moved to go out. Stay a moment. Show me those notes again. Ivan took out the notes and showed them to Smerdy. Smerdyakov looked at them for 10 seconds. Well, you can go, he said, with a wave of his hand. Ivan Fyodorovich, he called after him again. What do you want? Ivan turned without stopping. Goodbye. Till tomorrow, Ivan cried again, and he walked out of the cottage. The snowstorm was still raging. He walked the first few steps boldly, but began suddenly staggering. It's something physical, he thought with a grin. Something like joy was springing up in his heart. He was conscious of unbounded resolution. He would make an end of the wavering that had so tortured him of late. His determination was taken, and now it will not be changed, he thought with relief. At that moment he stumbled against something and almost fell down. Stopping short, he made out at his feet the peasant he had knocked down, still lying senseless and motionless. The snow had almost covered his face. Ivan seized him and lifted him in his arms. Seeing a light in the little house to the right, he went up, knocked at the shutters, and asked the man to whom the house belonged to help him carry the peasant to the police station, promising him 3 rubles. The man got ready to come out. I won't describe in detail how Ivan succeeded in his object, bringing the peasant to the police station and arranging for a doctor to see him at once, providing with a liberal hand for the expenses. I will only say that his business took a whole hour, but Ivan was well content with it. His mind wandered and worked incessantly. If I had not taken my decision so firmly for tomorrow, he reflected with satisfaction, I should not have stayed a whole hour to look after the peasant, but should have passed by without caring about his being frozen. I am being capable of watching myself. I am quite capable of watching myself, by the way, he thought, at the same instant, with still greater satisfaction, although they have decided that I am going out of my mind. Just as he reached his own house, he stopped short, asking himself suddenly, hadn't he better go at once to the prosecutor and tell him everything? He decided the question by turning back to the house. Everything together tomorrow, he whispered to himself. And strange to say, almost all his gladness and self-satisfaction passed in one instant. As he entered his own room, he felt something like a touch of ice on his heart, like a recollection, or more exactly, a reminder of something agonizing and revolting that was in that room now, at that moment, and had been there before. He sank wearily on his sofa. The old woman brought him a samovar. He made tea, but did not touch it. He sat on the sofa and felt giddy. He felt that he was ill and helpless. He was beginning to drop asleep, but got up uneasily and walked across the room to shake off his drowsiness. At moments he fancied he was delirious, but it was not illness and he thought of most. Sitting down again, he began looking around, as though searching for something. This happened several times. At last his eyes were fastened intently on one point. Ivan smiled, but an angry flush suffused his face. He sat a long time in his place, his head propped on both arms. Though he looked sideways at the same point, at the sofa that stood against the opposite wall, there was evidently something, some object, that irritated him there, worried him, and tormented him. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Have your say about that chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.